6 years ago, next month, a seminary classmate of mine, Scott Prinster, stood at our podium and told a story from our time together back in school. It was a story in which I had something to say, and it was a brave story for Scott to tell. And I've been waiting for the right time to reflect on it myself ever since then. Yes, it's been a while, but perspective can take a while. Our theme this month is covenant, which is a fitting time for this story. So I will share my version of Scott's story in just a minute, and I want to be clear with his express permission. The title of our talk today is taken from his talk then. Saying goodbye to the Lone Ranger is his phrase, and I am glad to borrow it. He wasn't talking, nor am I, about the radio show of that name or the 1950s TV character played by Clayton Moore. He was talking about the American propensity to go it alone, to embody the value of self-sufficiency beyond all else. He was talking about the limits to that and the ways we are more fully defined by our interactions with one another, by what we create together. Scott and I began our time in seminary in August of 92. At that time, the longest-running student group at the school was its men's group, because the number of female students at the school had long exceeded the number of men there. So by and large, the active member of the men's group were tight, and both Scott and I were active members. The group went camping or had some kind of outing twice a year, and the sharings at our weekly meetings were deep and often profound. At one point, one of us felt the time had come to shave the beard he had grown as soon as he was discharged from the army about 12 years before. So he did, and he did so in an absolutely singular, beautiful, and profound way. He asked us to help him shave off his beard. In fact, he borrowed a straight razor, along with a protective guide to keep things safe, from the beauty salon next to where he worked selling rugs, and invited those in the men's group to shave him and then to shave one another's faces. I had had a beard of my own for several years that was never going to be the Grizzly Adams beard I had longed for. So I showed up, and so did at least half a dozen others, that's okay, including Scott. At least for this straight man, touching another man's face can be a rare and intimate thing. There must have been three or four of us shaving each of our faces, one another's faces. And I learned, surprise, surprise, that different men have different ways of shaving. Some pulled the razor quickly, others slowly, but with more pressure. And then there's what it feels like to be shaved without looking in the mirror, not being able to see what's going on. Other than by feel, I couldn't tell what was going on. And then there's the feeling of shaving another man's face, of wanting to make absolutely sure you didn't slip anywhere near the other person's face. Even if the razor did, and this one did, as this one did, have a protective guard. I shaved last night so I wouldn't slip up this morning and have a razor mark. I want to be clear. While Scott didn't include that as that little tidbit as background for his story. I wanted to tell you about it now so that you had a clear sense for the context of the story he did share. Not only would many of the men in that group be colleagues in the future, but we had grown tight. And here is Scott's story in his own words. In the fall of 1993, while Eric and I were both immersed in our seminary studies, I became unable to keep up with the rent for my room in the Episcopalian dormitory, and I was evicted and spent the next few months homeless. I was deeply ashamed of not being able to provide for my basic needs, and I tried to keep my situation secret from my school and my classmates, living a shadow life behind the scenes of my public life. I had been working as Star King's custodian and had keys to everything. So I was able to store my possessions in a dark corner of the school's archives, and every night after all of my classmates had left the building, I bedded down on the floor in the basement bathroom, one of the very few rooms I could lock for some sense of privacy. Every morning I rose early, washed out in the sink. Come on, there we go. And packed away my sleeping bag before anyone else arrived in the building. Gradually, my classmates figured out what I was up to, and many offered their help. In fact, I spent several nights sleeping over at Eric's place while I saved up enough money to move myself into a studio apartment. It's worth adding, though, that Eric was the only one among us with the insight and the chutzpah to confront me about the central spiritual issue of my situation, that I had not trusted my friends with the knowledge of what I was going through, that in my pride and embarrassment, I had failed to uphold my accountability to that collegial community. That's Scott's story. And it's not exactly as I remember it. I don't recall putting him up for a few nights, though I might have. I do remember confronting Scott on at least one occasion, wishing that he had trusted the rest of us enough to let us help. When I realized what he was going through, it hurt. The men's group were tight. I wanted that bond to be strong. And Scott, in his understandable pride and understandable shame, didn't trust that the grout would be strong enough. I was angry at Scott. That was my guilt talking, I'm sure. But it was also my longing for the grout to be strong enough, for him to trust it, to trust us, to hold him to the extent that he needed to be held. I shared a house with five other grad students at the time. There was a couch he could have crashed on, and I'm sure others at school would have allowed him to crash at their places too. Still, Scott was understandably proud and understandably ashamed. Who could blame him for doing his best for keeping the situation private? And while I was upset that he hadn't reached out to me and the others at school, others in the men's group, it's not like I've never done the same, even since then. I may have told this story before, but I don't know if I've told the whole story. 3 years ago, the furnace in my house went out. It was old, 34 years old, it had done its time. And I think, as I've mentioned before, while I had worked out a mortgage I could afford, I hadn't budgeted on the need for, home repairs. Surprise. Anne was living out of state at that point, but when we spoke on the phone, she could tell that I was being evasive about something. Finally, I confessed to her that I had been camping out on a couch downstairs where it was warmer than upstairs in the bedroom. I had been setting aside for a few months for a new furnace, but it wasn't going to be enough to replace the old furnace before the start of winter. Thankfully, she figured out what was going on just about Thanksgiving time and sent a check that supplemented what I had saved, and the new furnace was installed in early December. So the last thing I want you to hear me saying is that I'm blaming Scott for not reaching out. Not at all. Not at all. There's a difference between expressing longing, hurt, even anger, and placing blame. At heart, what I want to lift up to you today is the nature of our agreements about what we can expect from one another, the covenant between us, if you will, the hold the grout has on us. In the Lone Ranger stories, the hero rides into town, puts his life on the line to set things straight, does so, and then heads off alone into the sunset. Funny how a man with a constant non-white companion is considered alone all the time, right? No strings would ever confine that man. He was a man with no past. There were no stories of his hopes or longing beyond the last commercial break. An American ideal, but only that. It's a fantasy of what life would be like if we didn't have responsibilities to one another that last, if we didn't have ties to others or vulnerabilities of any sort. But in the real world, we do. In the real world, we live amid grout. Sometimes it feels thick, maybe even too thick. It's got too much of a hold on us. Sometimes it may feel too thin. But its strength can't be known until we ask something of others. And paradoxically, it's at its thinnest when we ask either too little or too much too often. Amanda Palmer, from the reading Sam read earlier, gained her notoriety by both asking and giving back. For years, she was a living statue, busking in Cambridge as the 8-foot-tall bride. She responded when a dollar bill was placed in the hat before her with eye contact and the gift of a flower. She was also in a band, and when she broke from her record label and set up a Kickstarter crowdfunding site for her cabaret punk rock group and raised over $1 million to create a new record and start a tour, the media had a field day. She got all this money from folks. Wasn't she going to give any of it back? Like corporate welfare was never a thing. In our story earlier, everyone had to do something, whether they were good at it or not. But the truth is that none of us is great at everything. My neighbor Ben built his family a great new deck last spring. That's not something I'm to subject Anne to. Our partner church minister Albert Kozma and I had trouble getting his thumb drives to read on my computer, Ben's tech-savvy wife, Abby, came to our rescue. Me, I'm hoping I'm around long enough to do a great job at officiating at their 5-year-old son's wedding when that comes around. None of us can do it alone. We depend on others every minute of the day. Scott ended his talk by referring to a passage that has often been misattributed to the American novelist Herman Melville of Moby Dick fame. It was actually written in 1855 by a priest from the Church of England named Henry Melville, who preached, "We cannot live for ourselves alone. Our lives are connected in 1,000 invisible threads, and along these sympathetic fibers, our actions run as causes and return to us as results. Interconnectivity, interdependence, and community in the 19th century. More proof that there is nothing, or at least precious little, under the sun. We cannot live for ourselves alone. Our lives are connected by 1,000 invisible threads, and along these sympathetic fibers, our actions run as causes and return to us as results." Amanda Palmer reminds us that we ask for little things every day. A chair in a cafe, for someone to take our picture in front of a fountain when we find ourselves without a selfie stick. But there are bigger things we need to ask for as well. A couch to camp out on, a loan, a kidney. And this is a faith community, let me remind us, that has witnessed such a selfless gift, demonstrating just how strong our grout is and can be. Yet I'd wager that there are other requests still hiding behind mouths that are temporarily sewn shut. Let's see what a little faith can bring us, shall we? After all, how else can we be part of a living mosaic? Thank you.